Decades ago, beloved listeners, I remember writing a column on lifespan. I discovered the sad fact that the average human life lasts 27,000 days, and I remember telling Kerry Packer, then far and away our richest citizen, worth $6.5 billion, that when it came to ours, he was on the edge of bankruptcy. He had, at best, another 250,000 to live, and as it happened, he didn't even make the distance. I mention this because most of us think of the passage of time in terms of minutes, hours, days, and weeks. Measuring and noticing months, even years, is common, but once we start thinking in terms of decades or centuries, it becomes a bit more difficult. But for a geologist, their view of time is utterly different. Marcia Bjornerud is a professor of geology at Lawrence University in Appleton, Wisconsin, and she's here to tell us about her new book, Timefulness, that's one word, in which she urges us to develop a long-term view of the planet and its natural systems, thinking more like geologists and, less like politicians. Marcia, very good to have you on the program. Welcome.
Thank you so much, Philip.
Tell us about your idea of timefulness. What is it?
Right. So I hope the word invokes in people's minds mindfulness. And so it's a deliberate counterpoint in some ways to that idea, which is very much in currency here in the States, the idea that we should be living in the moment and perhaps not dwelling on the past and just be very present in the now. And so it's a deliberate counterpoint and pushing back against that idea a little bit, because I think although that might be helpful for individuals, it's not a good idea for a society to be really thinking only of the now. We need to enlarge the scope of our time window.
Marcia, no group thinks as much in the now as the politician, which means policy decisions are made on very short-term assumptions.
Exactly, and shorter all the time, it seems. Certainly in this country, we seem to be locked into, at most, about a two-year cycle during which the House of Representatives is constantly in election mode. And it's very difficult for anyone who has any kind of longer-term view to get any traction.
Tell us about the composer John Cage and his performance As Slow as Possible.
Yeah, so I use that composition as an example of several artworks that are deliberately designed to take place over several generations. And so it's an organ piece that is being performed in Germany on a very old organ. And I think since it began in 1989 or so, there have only been about a dozen chord changes. So it's played in part by people putting stones on the pedals of the organ and coming back a few months later and moving them. And people might scoff at something like this as a kind of gimmick, but it's a demonstration that we do have the capacity to work together on timescales that are longer than any individual lifespan. And we need to develop this kind of habit of planning and thinking and collaborative action if we're going to make it as a species over geologic time.
If we were to go back of, 100 years or so, were we more timeful then? It seems to me that perhaps there was more notion of the multi-generational timescale for simple folk.
I think that's true. More and more, our technologies give us the illusion that we are exempted from the passage of time. We are constantly distracted by novelty, and fewer of us are intersecting with the physical world through actual labor. We do virtual work that doesn't really involve any kind of understanding of the laws of physics. And so I think that too distances us from the intrinsic reality of time and the fact that many things take time to mature.
Not only does it distance us from the laws of physics, it also distances even from the seasons.
Absolutely. Yes, we live in climate-controlled buildings and can largely pretend that nature is sort of at a remove. It's just the backdrop rather than sort of one of the protagonists in our lives.
I love learning new words, and you've given me one, but you've got to now discuss it. Chronophobia.
Yeah, I made that one up, but if you parse it, it would mean fear of time. And I think that that's probably a good summary of where we in Western society are with our relationship with time. We personally fear it and loathe the fact that we age and are mortal. But larger, on a larger level too, our society doesn't want to come to grips with the passage of time and the effects of our industrial habits, and the fact that over time they're going to catch up with us.
I would have thought that the overwhelming fear of humanity, and this feeds into chronophobia, is the fear of death.
Certainly that's part of it, and all of us as individuals fear the loss of our loved ones and our own deaths. And again, as a society, don't really want to look in the face the fact that our cultures may not be what they are forever and ever. But I think there's a deeper and more interesting streak of chronophobia that runs in academia, even. The hierarchy of sciences is such that physics is sort of at the apex, maybe together with chemistry, and geology and biology, which are very entangled with time and histories and idiosyncratic evolutions of things, are not deemed quite as lofty endeavors. And I think that tells us a lot about our relationship with time. We revere timelessness more than we revere timefulness, things that have stories and deep evolutionary narratives.
Many, many years ago, I remember a geologist on the program talking about deep time. That's a concept which has to be comprehended.
Yes, that phrase, we should credit the writer John McPhee, who is not himself a geologist, but has written brilliantly and evocatively about many places, especially in the Western United States, to the extent that the Geological Society of America has given him an honorary membership. So he coined that phrase, deep time, and many of us use it because it, I think, invokes the spatial sense of time that we geologists develop in spending so much of our waking hours thinking about the geologic past. I know I feel almost as if time, the geologic timescale, is another dimension of the map. I can travel in my mind's eye to the Ordovician or the Cretaceous, and I feel like it's a place that I know well. So that deep time, it captures that spatial sense of time.
If we all had a sense of geological time, how might it change us individually and as a society?
Well, that's really the key point of my book, is that I think it would change our society profoundly. I think geology has for too long just flogged people over the head with the idea that the Earth is immensely old and slow to change without telling the stories of the Earth very effectively. Just talking about billions of years is alienating. It's hard to understand, and it doesn't seem there's any place for us in that story. But if we start sharing more effectively the many fascinating stories of the development of the Earth as a whole and the individual stories in Australia or North America or wherever you are, then we start developing a relationship with the planet's long history that we see does include us. Our own species is relatively recent, but we have deep roots in this place, and we're going to be here as it unfolds into an uncertain future, and we urgently need to know those stories. So I'm hopeful that maybe knowing them will change our cultural perspective on who we are.
I'm glad you mentioned John McPhee. He's long been one of my favorite essayists. Another great writer who shares your view and is a friend of the program is Simon Winchester. He, like you, just finds the endless revelations of geology so profound.
Yes, I know Simon's work well, and probably most famously, his map that changed the world is one that I use in teaching quite often. He's brilliant at telling both Earth's story and then how human stories are entangled with tectonics or paleontology. And I think that's another way we can reach people who are coming in from the outside, is the whole endeavor of unfurling the depths of geologic time has been a very human thing, with people from many cultures over time contributing to this great tapestry of time that we finally have a fairly good, well-calibrated sense for.
Marcia, let's talk about the patron saint, if you like, of geology, and that's James Hutton. Tell us about James.
So Hutton, yes, he is, I think, rightly viewed as the father figure of Western geology. He was on the fringes of the Edinburgh Enlightenment in the late 1700s. He rubbed shoulders with people like James Watt and David Hume. And he was a gentleman farmer, but a physician by training. And he owned quite a bit of land right on the border between England and Scotland, and noticed as a farmer that he was losing soil in large quantities each year to erosion. And this bothered him. And as a believing man, a religious man, he thought God would not allow the earth simply to be worn down in this way. He really thought there must be some compensating force that would rebuild the land and not just allow it to be eroded steadily down. And so he was sort of primed to be looking for evidence of rejuvenation, and apparently found it during a sea expedition at a promontory on the coast of Scotland that is called Siccar Point. It's kind of a geological mecca. And there he saw two sequences of sedimentary rocks, a lower sequence in which the beds were tilted at a very steep angle, and then a rather irregular surface, and then on top of that surface, another sequence of rocks that were more or less horizontal. And he very perceptively recognized that surface dividing the two sequences of rocks must have represented the time it would take to erode a mountain belt to sea level, because the underlying rocks, the tilted ones, represented some kind of great crustal upheaval, and he linked that with mountain building. And then he recognized that mountain must have been erased by erosion, and then a new sequence of rocks laid down at sea level, beginning the cycle again. And so we point to that epiphany as sort of the birth of the recognition in the West, anyway, of deep time, that it had to be much, much longer than the few thousand years or so that the Christian Bible seemed to imply.
Marcia, how do your young earthers, your creation students, explain the rock record, let alone the fossil record?
Well, again, I think many of them have to grapple with that pretty early on. It becomes harder and harder as you become a scientist to reconcile the two views. And I think that many prefer to move away from a literal interpretation. One thought experiment I share with students and others, if they really are struggling with these two views of the world, is this. What is more disturbing? If you believe in God, the idea that there was a creation event 4.5 billion years ago, that the Earth has had a long and complex history of geological and biological evolution leading up to the present day, and that is an amazing, rich story? Or do you prefer a deceitful creator who has planted every evidence of a very ancient Earth in every fossil bed, in every crystal we might pick up to do isotopic dating on, merely to trick us into thinking that the Earth is very old? And that's a rather blunt way to put it, but I think at some point that's what students of geology need to grapple with if they come out of those sorts of religious backgrounds, because any casual glimpse of geologic phenomena lead you to the conclusion that the Earth is very old.
I know you're aware of the significance of the Pilbara in northwestern Australia, and being a provincial, I'm tempted to ask you about it. Why does the Pilbara matter?
Oh, and it's not provincial at all in the minds of geologists. The Pilbara Block is just an amazingly rich archive of very early times on Earth. Most famously, there is the Strelipool Chert, which has yielded some of the most ancient direct fossil life forms. They're single-celled, of course, and but as of about 2 years ago, I think everybody agrees they definitely are microfossils. It has also yielded the very oldest Earth objects we've ever found, which are crystals of the mineral zircon, which is an amazingly tough and resistant mineral. It's embedded in a sandstone in the Pilbara Block. But that sandstone apparently sampled some truly ancient crust that was as old as 4.4 billion years, so just 100 million years or so after Earth formed. We have a few vestiges of that earliest crust on Earth. So Pilbara is known all around the world as this just amazing treasure chest of information about the earliest Earth.
Your science also tells us a great deal about the great extinctions, doesn't it?
It does, yes, and they're sobering things to study. I'm right now teaching a course I teach every year called History of Earth and Life, and we're coming to the end of our 10-week winter term, and I find myself rather exhausted because in the last 3 weeks we've had to talk about five great mass extinction events of the geologic past, and this week we're focusing on what many people call the sixth extinction, which is happening now. And we're doing a kind of comparative study of the factors that seem to have led to the previous five. And it's sobering to see how many of the environmental crises of the past are very familiar to us today.
Basia, we're running out of time, so I'd like to give you the opportunity to wrap it up and to restate your central hypothesis. Advise us on what we should be doing.
Well, I think the habit of timefulness, which is an awareness that we are temporal, temporary creatures, but that we occupy a place that has a long history, can change us personally, maybe make us a little bit less neurotic, a little bit more at peace with our own mortality, but it can also change our perspective as a society about what we want our legacy to be. I know somebody who always signs off on his emails with the bon mot, be a good ancestor. And I think maybe that's my main message.
You are a charming and timely guest. Marcia Bjornerud, a professor of geology at Lawrence University. She's a fellow of the Geographical Society of America and was a 2000 to 2001 Fulbright Scholar. Marcia, thank you.